Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the Slightly Foxed podcast. This is a podcast for adventurous readers who like to get off the beaten track, people who want to read books that last, not just books that are fashionable right now. Many wonderful books just fade out of memory. The Slightly Foxed team hunt them down and bring them to light. They publish a quarterly magazine, and over the years it's become an indispensable guide for thousands of readers all over the world. Why? Well, it's entirely independent for one thing, and it's unpretentious. It's less literary magazine and much more well-read friend. Every month we'll be gathering round the Slightly Foxed kitchen table here in Hoxton Square in East London. We'll be talking about books you might know, as well as books you've definitely never heard of, and we'll be sharing the ups and downs of life at a magazine quite unlike any other. Let's have some introductions. My name is Philippa Lamb. I'm a friend of Slightly Foxed, and I'm here to help them make their podcast.
Hello, I'm Gail Perkis, and I'm one of the founders of Slightly Foxed and also one of the editors.
I'm Hazel Wood. I'm one of the co-founders of Slightly Foxed and also Gail's co-editor.
Hello, I'm Stephanie Allen. I've been with Slightly Foxed from day one. I look after press and marketing, and I've worked with Gail and Hazel for many years.
Now, we'll hear from other people here at Foxed in future podcasts, but we are starting with you three because, you know, as you say, Steph, you've all been here since day one. Well, not here, literally in Hoxton Square, because I think it started around a kitchen table, didn't it?
It absolutely did start around the kitchen table, usually with a bottle of wine on the table.
which is why under the table.
Dogs under the table. Okay. And actually a baby. The table. The dogs have moved on. We have a new generation of dogs.
Yes, we'll be hearing from the dogs, I rather suspect, whether we want
I'm
to
afraid
or not.
You will.
So we better introduce the dogs. How many?
We have three. Two of them belong to me. One is a rather grumpy 10-year-old Cocker Spaniel called Chudley. And then there's the young Flibbity Gibbet Stanley, who is a blonde Cocker Spaniel with incredible eyelashes. And then Jenny, who runs our office, has a beautiful whippet called Tarka.
We're surrounded by towering piles of books. Of course, the quarterly magazine itself. It does smell deliciously like a bookshop or a library in here. And this, of course, is the air you all breathe every day. So tell me what's caught your eye recently in your world. Steph?
I'm often on the lookout for interesting marketing campaigns. And earlier this week, I spotted Granta and the National Health Service have launched a campaign around the country, #ShareAPint. And it's right. Encouraging customers to donate blood. They're promoting Rose George's book, 9 Pints, A Journey Through the Miraculous World of Blood.
Okay.
And I thought that was incredibly clever.
Do we know if it's working effectively? Are people signing up? Were you tempted?
Yes.
Okay. Hazel.
Well, I was up in Suffolk and I went to a lovely place called the Leaping Hare in an old farm complex. And it's a beautiful restaurant and it's a shop full of things that the owner loves, pottery, fabrics. And there's also a very, very nice sort of book room in which Slightly Foxed features, actually. But it did strike me how booksellers are having to be so quick-footed, really.
It's intriguing, isn't it? Because that's a remote location.
Well, I think bookshops really have to try very, very hard now. I mean, there's hardly a children's section that doesn't have toys in it. They've become a kind of community hub, really, with all sorts of things going on.
Because you have alliances with a lot of bookshops, don't you? I think probably we'll get into it in later episodes.
We do, yes. I read an obituary last week of a translator called Anthea Bell. She translated a lot of rather wonderful literature from the German and the French, W.G. Sebald, Sigmund Freud. But at the other end of the spectrum, she translated the Asterix books, and she did so distinctively and successfully that they became a masterpiece in their own right in English.
So for people who don't know Asterix,
it's a cartoon series about Gauls in Gaul who are resisting the Roman occupation.
And it sounds odd when you describe it like that, but it is
excellent. They have magic powers. So they have a druid, who in the English translation is rather aptly called Getafix, and they have a dog who's called Dogmatix.
I think we're kind of getting the idea.
The Roman soldiers are given glorious names like Infirm of Purpose. And so
she must have had a lot of fun with that.
She must have had a lot of fun. And it just reminded me of what fun the Asterix books are. And I think I should go back to them.
Well, let's talk a bit about what's coming up in this episode. We're all interested, obviously, in how great reads somehow get forgotten. So for this first one, we thought it would be interesting to talk about the old and the new, that tension between the vast literary back catalogue and the ephemeral bestseller lists. We'll be joined later on by today's guest, Jim Ring, author, filmmaker and a regular contributor to The Quarterly. After that, we have a real treat for the ear, a specially recorded reading of a piece from the very first edition of Slightly Foxed. It's about a book by Anne Faderman, and if you've never heard of her, that's excellent news, because introducing you to writers and books you don't yet know is what this podcast is all about. Later on, we'll have some recommended reads, books from off the beaten track, naturally. And finally, we did think you would enjoy a peep into the day-to-day work of producing this literary magazine. Now, Gail, Hazel, Steph, you are old friends. You all work together at a legendary publishing house, John Murray. Tell us a bit about it.
We all worked in a glorious Queen Anne house in the heart of Mayfair. They published Lord Byron, they published Jane Austen, Charles Darwin, David Livingstone, John Betjeman.
Conan Doyle.
I mean, the list
is
endless, and as well as a very distinguished traveller list in the 20th century. And it was quite a patriarchal firm, but it was also like a big family, and it was very much editorially led, and we were very privileged to be there. But unfortunately, in 2002, the company was sold to a much larger corporation, dreaded word.
Okay.
And I'm afraid that none of us felt that we really fitted in to that sort of structure, so we left.
So how did that change the publishing philosophy there then? What was different? What made you feel it wasn't for you anymore?
Very much marketing-based, really. We found that the editorial meetings really became marketing meetings, and the whole idea of, or the originality of the book being the main thing, it became much more, if an author had written one successful book, they wanted another like it.
So no opportunity for authors to evolve over time and become things they hadn't been before?
No. Exactly. Mm. And I think that wasn't a problem that was unique. I think it happened in a lot of publishing houses.
And across the whole book trade, really, wasn't it? Because that, I think I'm right in saying, that was the time when the first big bookshop chains were emerging, and it was all about the new.
Yes.
And very interesting stocking backlist. So the shelves were full of new books, but if you wanted to go and find a copy of, I don't know, George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, for example, you know, one of his slightly less well-known books, chances are you wouldn't find it.
So that was the background.
That was the background.
And it wasn't for you.
We had the idea for a magazine that would champion the backlist, first of all, but also books that we felt had slipped from view or had never been recognised properly in the first place.
An interesting idea. So it was all about reviving existing work.
Yes.
There are a lot of literary magazines out there, aren't there? But the way you choose what appears in yours is quite different. So tell me how that works.
It is. So most literary magazines are sent books by publishers, by the publicity department, for review. And the literary editor on a newspaper or a magazine will send it out to a reviewer who probably has some expertise in that particular field. So it's very judgmental.
And none of that applies here. How do you do it?
We ask people to write about things they love, that they have a passion for. So it's a personal approach. We actually actively encourage them to bring themselves into the article, to where they're learning likely, to write in an approachable way.
Yeah.
It means there isn't a distance between the person who's writing and the book itself. They're transmitting their own enjoyment and involvement with the book.
And your contributors aren't journalists, or some are, but they're not all.
They're a real mixture. Some are very distinguished writers, novelists, historians, biographers. Many of them are jobbing journalists, which sounds like a pejorative term, but actually I have enormous respect for them because, my goodness, they can master a brief and they don't have egos. And then we have people who do completely different things. A friend of Hazel's wrote some lovely pieces for us, and he was a hospital administrator, wasn't he?
Yes. I mean, they come from, as they always say, all walks of life.
And we've had the infamous article on the Seagull outboard motor.
The Seagull outboard motor.
The manual for the motor.
I'm struggling to believe that that would be an enjoyable piece.
Because so many manuals, well, they're incomprehensible usually.
Sure.
But this was written in beautiful prose and was not just about the engine and the way it worked. It infused the manual with a love of getting out on the water
So it's a celebration of the work, whatever it is.
Whatever it is. I mean, we have Georgette Heyer as well as Proust, as it were.
Okay, so yes. Not sniffy and about popular writers.
No.
Ghost stories, M.R. James, for example. We've had pieces on crime fiction. We've even had a piece on Modesty Blaise, which started off as a cartoon in a national tabloid, I think. So, yes, we're not snobbish about this. We believe that reading is a pleasurable activity, and there are some books you need at particular times in your life, and they're for pleasure, for comfort, diversion, inspiration.
Yeah, you call your subscribers real readers, I've noticed.
Well, they're not really interested only with being kind of up to date with the latest book.
Enthusiasts.
The book that they need at that moment.
We used to have a tagline in our the leaflets that we produce. Do you like to go to bed with a trollop? Trollop with an E, of course.
Of course.
Do you carry elderly penguins in your pocket? So it's an obsession with print, I suppose.
So those people are your people.
And I think that's a
Fox
fair
people.
Description of a slightly yes. foxed reader. Yeah.
Yes. When I think about the time you started on this crusade, it was entirely contracyclical, wasn't it? It was the time when everyone was obsessed with the new, and that's what it's been like for the last 20, 25 years. It's been about the disposable society, fresh ideas, new things, binary judgment. It's a good book. It's a bad book. I should buy it. I shouldn't buy it. And that's not... You're not doing any of that.
No.
No, and people were a bit dubious when we started. People said things like, well, good luck with that. I think we were even a bit dubious.
There's actually been a remarkable revival in publishers' backlists, and there's a lot of reissuing of, I mean, for example, Muriel Spark's entire back catalogue has just been reissued. So there are many more writers now in print than there were when we started, and I hope we can take a little bit of credit for that,
yeah.
Because it's quite noticeable how many publishers actually subscribe to Slightly Foxed, and how an article will appear on a book, and lo and behold, a year or two later, you'll find this person has come back in print, which is
really?
Quite gratifying.
That
yes.
must be very pleasing.
Yes.
Excellent. Let's bring in our guest, Jim Ring, award-winning biographer. I know you write historic accounts and novels, often but not exclusively, relating to the sea. And, of course, you've written a number of pieces for Slightly Foxed over the years, including one about the classic children's series, Swallows and Amazons. Now, I know Gail was your editor way back when, in the John Murray days. The approach here, it's very different to the way other literary magazines commission their pieces. It must be quite liberating for you.
It's hugely liberating. Slightly Foxed contributors, and we are a privileged lot, do not write to order. The books that we write about, we know backwards. Swallows and Amazons in particular, I read as a child. They were read to me as a child by my mother. I then went on to read them, I think, three or four times over to my own two children. So I think I know them reasonably well.
I'm sure you know them more than reasonably well, but there's a thing sometimes when you're writing a piece, and they're about being too close to the material.
I think you have to step away from the books to write a good piece, and I think the best of writers, and I would certainly not include myself within that, are writing little masterpieces. They are miniatures, aren't they? And they are works of art, the best of them in their own right.
I mean, I'm treated, obviously, Swallows and Amazons is their iconic books, but children's books from long ago. I mean, I've noticed you've covered quite a number of them in the Quarterly. You don't shy away from encouraging adults to read children's books.
Absolutely not, no. I think it's one of the, I don't know whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, aspects of getting older is that you tend to go back to the books of your youth that you loved. And go back to children's books, very often it's a happy experience. If you go back to books you read as an adolescent and loved, it can be really quite disheartening. I've been back to some terrible things I read as an adolescent, which were incredibly pretentious.
So there's a bit of nostalgia.
I think in the case of children's books, I don't think you should classify them as children's books. They're great books that children happen to enjoy. And the really good writers, like Rosemary Sutcliffe, for example, are as skilled in what they do as any literary novelist you care to mention.
I mean, I think Ransom made the point, certainly in his letters, that he never felt that he himself was writing for children. And he also said that he thought that if he did so, the result would be catastrophic. I don't think, in fact, Swallows and Amazons can be reasonably categorised as children's literature. any more than I would regard Richmond Crompton, the Just William series, as books that can be enjoyed only by children, or, you know, The Wind in the Willows.
Indeed. I mean, for you, I think it is fair to say maritime matters come to the fore in a lot of your writing, don't they? I mean, the other end of the scale, as far away from Swallows and Amazons as we can get. You wrote a piece about the Riddle of the Sands, didn't you? The Erskine Childers spy novel, really.
Yeah,
early
Erskine
spy.
Erskine Childers' masterpiece.
Yeah, it is a masterpiece. Yes. For people who don't know it, a very quick...
Oh, a synopsis. Well, written in the context of the great naval race that preceded the Great War, we have two amateur yachtsmen who sail across the German Frisian Islands, and they discover a dastardly plot masterminded by the Kaiser to invade England.
God forbid.
Absolutely, and what a wonderful story it is. It is also the yachtsman's favourite book.
Because it's so full of technical matters.
Because it is so full of technical matters. In fact, rather like Arthur Ransom, and of the various books mentioned in the Arthur Ransom canon, Erskine Childers was one of the most important, The Riddle of the Sands.
You went on to write a biography of Erskine Childers, didn't you?
Who I did.
Is the most, or was the most extraordinary character.
Yes, that was the only novel that he wrote. But then, you know, this scholarly man, he was a clerk to the House of Commons, went on to become one of the fathers of modern Ireland. He was one of the leaders of the movement that gave Ireland independence in 1922. And then, of course, he got shot by the Irish for his trouble.
Yeah.
So it's an extraordinary story, a multifaceted life. He was one of the pioneers of aerial photography, bizarrely enough, over Gallipoli. He was a very complex figure.
Well worth a dig into for anyone who's tempted by what they've heard, because I was astonished when I realised quite what there was to him. Because the book in itself is great, but Childers' own life is like a novel in itself, isn't it? We will be recommending other reads later on, but knowing that I'd be talking to Jim, actually, I've just bought Riddle of the Sands again because I lost my copy in a house move. And talking of which, let's hear our first piece, which is, appropriately enough, all about collecting books. Hazel, tell us a bit about it.
The reading you're going to hear is the first piece in our very first issue of Slightly Foxed, which appeared in spring 2004. It's written by Liz Robinson, a freelance editor and an obsessive reader who Gail and I both knew when we were at John Murray. And it's about a book called Ex Libris by Anne Faderman. And we think that it sums up the world of books and readers that Slightly Foxed is all about.
Because it's all about being overrun by books, isn't it?
It's about being overrun by books, yes.
Do you treasure ancient paperbacks, spines gone, pages browning, brittle and crumbling? Held together, or not quite, with perished elastic bands, simply because you also treasure the memories they evoke, as much by their physical appearance as by their contents? Do you have to fight the urge to correct typos in library books and in menus? Do you like to read Persuasion while standing in Milsom Street in Bath, or on the Cob at Lyme? If the answer to one or more of these questions is even a hesitant yes, then you'll find in Anne Faderman a kindred spirit. And in the pages of Ex Libris, Confessions of a Common Reader, you will recognise yourself. A writer and editor married to a writer, Anne Faderman grew up with books. Small wonder, then, that these essays should so felicitously illuminate so many of the more idiosyncratic byways and manifestations of that curious condition that is being enthralled to books. Take marriage. Specifically, marriage between two people who both possess quite a number of books. It was, says Faderman, a good thing the Book of Common Prayer didn't say anything about marrying our libraries and throwing out the duplicates. The crunch, the deal-breaker, is the arrangement of the conjugal library, especially if, like Miss Faderman and her husband George, one of you is a splitter and the other a lumper. Anne scores early points, George being reasonable enough to concede that while he could find his books if they were arranged like mine, I could never find mine if they were arranged like his. When we married 30-odd years ago and moved to an army base in Germany, my husband and I were limited by army regulations to only 6 boxes of stuff. It didn't matter then because we had only 3 or 4 yards of books between us. In the small towns of the Lüneburg Heath, it was quite hard to acquire more books. But we must have done so, for I well remember one young officer's wife remarking to another in tones of mingled disgust and horror that Mark and Liz give each other books for presents. Now, after more than a quarter of a century in the same house, the book crisis seems to be insoluble. We've pretty much run out of walls against which to build bookshelves. Not that I've been able to find much since the last set of bookshelves went up in the living room. I'm in the lumper class, and the living room books tend to be loosely grouped by subject. A good many are reference books, and those are easy enough to find if they come in multiple volumes, like the Dictionary of National Biography, long yearned for, but quite unlooked for. The Oxford English Dictionary, all 20 volumes of it, plus supplements, was a naughty present to myself. Feelings of guilt only partly assuaged by my daughter's assertion that she was looking forward to inheriting it. No, it's all the odd things that go astray in a non-alphabetical rearrangement. Books one consults perhaps two or three times a year, or even only every 2 or 3 years. Yet how wonderful it is to have them to hand, if only they were, because they're no longer where you remember seeing them last. And I've lost count of the number of hours I've wasted looking for a short, stout blue book that turns out, when eventually run to earth, to be tall, thin and red. And never forget fading. I once spent 3 days searching for a book that really was stout and red, but its spine, I had forgotten, was faded to a light biscuity colour. As to biscuits, in another essay, Anne Faderman recalls that Charles Lamb once told Coleridge that he was especially fond of books containing traces of buttered muffins, which not only reminded me of the cocoa stain in my own much-loved copy of Pride and Prejudice, but also sent me off to hunt out Lamb's essays of Elia. Shelves in the bedroom on the left of the window, the small ones on the top, specially designed for Victorian and Edwardian pocket editions. I can find some of my books. Books wrote our life story, she says of the period of 4 years during which the essays in Ex Libris were written. And as they accumulated on our shelves and on our windowsills and underneath our sofa and on top of our refrigerator, they became chapters in it themselves. How could it be otherwise?
Pretty well everything she said applies to my own household. I don't know about you. Lumper or splitter?
I waver. We built a house some years ago, and when we moved in, I put all the fiction in one section, arranged by author, and all the biography and memoirs went somewhere else. And recently I decided that actually it was quite ridiculous to have Virginia Woolf's novels in one part of the house and then her letters and journals in an entirely different room. Mm. So I spent a very happy week last winter taking everything off the shelves and rearranging them. Nearly drove me mad, but it was worth it.
But it's all very well, isn't it, having a system? But if you live with someone else, they do, as she says in that piece, have their own system and they don't necessarily stick by your rules.
They do, and we have terrible arguments about I'm a great one for getting rid of books that I don't enjoy and my husband is very resistant, so I have to smuggle them out of the house.
Yeah, that's a whole conversation, isn't it, about the getting rid of books or the not. I think we're going to have to save that for another episode. We need to move on. As you would expect, everyone at Foxt is a voracious reader. And there are many more books being consumed under this roof than can ever be highlighted in the quarterly. So shall we have recommendations? Steph, what have you got?
I'm rereading Jean Rhys's Wide Sargasso Sea, which is her imaginative prequel to Jane Eyre. Jean Rhys was a white Creole. She was brought up in the Caribbean. And the book is part autobiographical and part prompted by her outrage when she read Jane Eyre and thought that the treatment of the mad wife in the attic was appalling.
Yes, Mrs. And Rochester stashed away in the attic for being insane. Yes. Yeah.
And set out to write her own life of Bertha, or Antoinette, that was her real name, but Rochester called her Bertha, in a sense, taking away herself.
Yes, her identity. Yes. He rebranded her, didn't he? It was a fascinatingly original idea, the White Sargasso Sea. I mean, who on earth would have thought of it?
Yes.
Gail?
I've recently finished an author who I've never come across before, to my shame, because I think in America she's extremely well-known and highly regarded. And the book was Jane Smiley's 1,000 Acres, which I had read about somewhere and went and bought a copy and was completely and utterly transfixed. It's a retelling of King Lear, basically, but set in Iowa a farmer in late age decides to sell, well, not to sell his farm, but to split it up between the three daughters. And of course, it all goes horribly wrong. And I think what I loved about it, quite apart from the fact that I was gripped despite knowing what the ending was going to be, it gives the most remarkable evocation of life in the Midwest and lets you enter a whole new world. And I found that fascinating.
Interesting. I didn't know that one, so that's now on my list too. Hazel?
Well, I'm reading, or rather rereading, a diarist who I absolutely adore, and I turn to him when I need to move into another world, really. He's called James Lees Milne. He was born in 1908 into a sort of minor aristocratic family. He went to Eton and to Oxford and didn't do terribly well. And it looked as if he was going to have a rather dim career until he got a job with the Embryonic National Trust in 1936. The National Trust had mainly been concerned until then with preserving countryside, sort of beauty spots. But at that time, of course, just before the war, and all the big houses were beginning to crumble without servants. And when war came along and they were requisitioned, the owners, who'd been rather snooty about the idea of giving them to the National Trust before, suddenly found it all rather interesting. And Jim's job was to travel round looking at the houses and talking to their owners.
So negotiate with their owners for the handover of their crumbling piles to the National Trust. And the first one is Ancestral?
The first one is called Ancestral Voices. And in it he goes to, well, houses which now, of course, are as trim as anything, but in those days were crumbling away with no electricity, owners sitting in corners of rooms with rugs over them. But Jim was perfectly at home in this environment, and he persuaded many an owner to hand over their house. And it was really he who started the enormous drive to preserve the country house. He's both quite sharp about other people, and he's said to be snobbish, but he isn't really. He's very nostalgic about an England that's passing, and he's rather vulnerable himself and rather shy. So he's a kind of paradox, really. He was gay, but he was married.
And there are 12 volumes?
There are 12 volumes, so there are 11 more to go after Ancestral Voices.
Yeah, it's always very enjoyable. If you've done something you love, and then there are many, many more to go after.
Yes, and I love diaries because they're so unguarded, really, in a way that a memoir or a biography isn't.
Now, before we wrap up this first podcast, which we absolutely must do, we did promise to give you a peep into the life of a small publishing house. So let's have a quick update on what's going on here at the moment. I think I'm right saying the Winter Quarterly is out today, isn't it?
It is. It's being dispatched from our printers today, which is very exciting because it's our 60th issue. So it's a bit of a landmark for us.
I'm imagining you've done something very special for the cover.
We have. We have always had a lot of wood engravings to illustrate articles, and we have a particular fondness for them. So for the 60th issue, we decided to commission a wood engraving of a fox from an artist called Chris Wormel, who's one of England's leading wood engravers. And you'll see him sitting proudly on the front cover. And then we thought it would be fun on the inside cover, which is normally blank, to have a bit of a joke. So we commissioned Posy Simmons, a wonderful cartoonist, to do drawings of the office staff in situ. Not just the staff, but also the office dogs.
Okay.
So on the inside front and back cover, there are Posy's images of us all. When the drawings arrived, we laughed, but Hazel and I did say to each other, do we really look that fat? We both look like cottage buns.
Because I should say at this point, neither of you is fat. So
thank you, Philippa.
Well, maybe what?
So Hazel said, do you think we could ask her to make us a bit thinner? And I'm afraid I roared with laughter and said, Hazel, this is a conversation I've got to overhear. Yeah. You're very welcome to if you want to.
You can't really. You've commissioned a cartoonist.
We decided, that really we should stop being so vain, basically. I have to say that the most beautiful creatures in these drawings are of course, the dogs.
Of course. Goes without saying. And I am imagining that this is the busiest time of the year for you, isn't it? The run-up to Christmas?
It certainly is. Basically, from September through till Christmas, the office goes slightly mad. And we spend an awful lot of time stuffing envelopes and wrapping parcels and answering phone calls. But it's all joyful because it's all lovely books going to lovely people.
Yes, because we haven't even mentioned the fact that you publish books,
exactly.
Which is something we can talk about in future episodes. But you do. And so, yes, pre-Christmas, a very busy time. We will be back on December the 15th with another episode. So now actually is the time to subscribe so that every episode will pop automatically and conveniently into your phone or laptop. If you're curious to know more about anything we've mentioned today, you can find show notes for this episode on the website, where you'll also find details of all the books we've talked about, so all the books and all the authors. And while you're there, have a dig around, because you can find out all about Slightly Foxed. And you can browse through the catalogue of Slightly Foxed books, which, as you will see, they are the most beautiful cloth-bound editions, perfect for Christmas gifts. And thanks for joining us off the beaten track.